It's good to be here again. My name is Joe Abbey Colburn. I'm half of your pastor. Between the two of us, we're almost a complete person. I'm a chaplain at Belmont House, which is a long-term care facility. I'm part-time there 2 days a week. I'll be here 3 days a week. It's a nursing home in Toronto, downtown. And I've worked in various faith, interfaith, and faith-based ministries for the last 22 years. I was the founding director of Faith in the City, which is a multi-faith network of faith communities, nonprofits, social activists, city councilors even, and senior city staff. And we were working on ways to engage faith communities in social issues in their neighborhoods. And to work across their faith boundaries in partnerships with nonprofits and with the city. I did that for about 4 years, 5 years now. It's still running. I'm not with them anymore. It was great. We got that launched. I was the pastoral director of Parkdale Neighborhood Church in Parkdale in the south, just above the exhibition grounds in Toronto. I was there for 10 years. I was working there with a deeply building community in people's lives, some of the most marginalized people in the city, people living with mental health issues, addiction issues related to poverty. And before that, I worked on staff, on the pastoral staff at Sanctuary in the downtown core. It's a ministry devoted and centralizing people who are street involved and the chronically homeless and all the related issues to that. So that's my sort of 22-year history of ministry. But prior to that, I was involved in social services. I worked with youth mostly in community work and street work and family work in the city of Toronto. And prior to that, gosh, I worked in theater for several years as an actor. Yes, I actually made a living as an actor for a little while. And I'm married to Donna, and I have two kids, two grown men, adult sons, Elliot and Blake. That's me. Now, what I've just done now, in the last 2 minutes, was I've done a kind of an introduction that we're used to hearing a lot in our lives. When we get to know somebody, we kind of get their mini CV. When we are getting to know people, we present ourselves and we present this kind of curated, manicured image of who we are, and we include certain things and we leave out certain things. And what I've just done is pretty typical of a lot of what we do in our culture. I was at an event a few years ago. It was a peace conference in the St. Catharines area. Drew people from all over. And one of the guest speakers there was an Anglican Indigenous bishop. He was a First Nations guy. He's an Anglican bishop, Mark MacDonald. And he introduced himself to us. And this is how he introduced himself. So if I'm Mark MacDonald. He didn't say his name at the beginning. He stood up and he said, "My mother was Sue Nell, and she was from," and he listed where she was from, "and her mother was," and gave her name, "and she was from this part of the country, and her mother was this person, and she was actually from the Minnesota area," what's now Minnesota. "And then on my father's side," and he listed her mother, and then the grandmother, and then the great-grandmother, and where they were each from. And he said, in their culture, that's how they would introduce themselves. They would introduce, you would never introduce yourself. You would never put yourself forward. You would say who your mother was, and who her mother was, and who her mother was, as far back as you could go. And you'd talk about the places that they lived. You'd talk about the places where they were from, because the places were important. The people and the place was important. And when you were introducing yourself, you were constantly looking for ways that you might connect to the person you're introducing yourself to, either in people or in place. And the person who was listening, they would be listening and they would be trying to figure out, are we related? Are we clan? Are we somehow connected to each other, maybe in place or in people? And so now we come to the congregational participation part of the sermon. I want everybody here, I'm going to explain what I want you to do. I want you to introduce yourself to someone in the congregation that you, preferably someone you don't know real well. Do not introduce yourself to someone in your own family. Thank you. Introduce yourself to someone that you don't know real well, and this is the template I want you to use. Slide, please. Thank you. Who was your mother? Where was she from? Who was her mother? Where was she from? As far back as you can go. If you don't know, don't worry about it. Who is the person that you might consider to be your mother if you were adopted? Who's the person you consider to be your mother? Where are they from? Go that route, okay? It's who you claim as mother. So who do you claim as mother? Who do you claim, and where was she from? Grandmother, and where was she from? Go back as far as you can, and when you get to the end of that, if you have time, go to father. Who was your father's mother, and where was she from? Who was your father's grandmother, and where was she from? And see, when you're in your partners, the people who are listening, the person who's listening, try and find in your listening a place where you might be connected, either in person or in place. And try, if you can think of one thing about one of your ancestors, mother, grandmother, whatever, one thing that you think might connect with them. And she was into knitting, and I think maybe you're into knitting. Or she was into cooking, or she made a great cake. So anything that you can think of like that, but one thing, only one thing in all of it. You have 60 seconds to tell as much as you can. Just in the interest of time. If we had a whole day together, we'd go longer. Just in the interest of time. You have 60 seconds to tell, and then we'll switch. And so one of you is A, one of you is B. A goes first, telling their lineage. B listens for places where you might be connected. Then we switch, and B gets to tell their lineage, and A listens for places where you might be connected. Everybody got it? If you get lost, here's the template. My mother my mother was born or grew up in, her mother was. So I'll give you an example. My mother, this is Joe, this is me speaking. My mother was Betty Harvey, and she was born in Kenora, Saskatchewan, not Kenora, Ontario, Kenora, Saskatchewan. And her mother was Evelyn Patterson, and she was born in Rodney, Ontario, just not too far, just north of Lake Erie. And that's as far as I can go. And my father's mother was Ruby Elderkin. And I don't know where she was born. That's it. That's all I got. So, and my great-great-grandmother made a great coffee cake. But I can't remember how I'm related to her. Okay. I'm going to give you 1 minute to find a partner, someone, if you're mobile, get up and move to someone who might be not be as mobile, stand up, move around, you have 30 seconds to find a partner. Find your partner, don't start your genealogy. Who has not got a partner? If you've not got a partner, put your hand up. You're going to have to get up. You're going to have to get up. You're going to have to. We have an odd number of people. Okay. On your mark. Get set. A goes first. Who was your mother? Go. No, you just got more relatives. You can stop now. Anytime. Okay. Woo, Nelly. Have a seat. Question. Pardon? Very good question. So the question was, why is the focus on the mothers and not and no mention of the fathers? And the way he explained it, he said, we're a maternal society. The indigenous cultures that he was, the First Nations folks here, we're a maternal society. The stories and the wealth of knowledge and the history and all of that is contained by the mothers and the grandmothers. And so those, it emphasizes that lineage. Kind of who you are is who your mothers were. And then the mothers are more important even on the father's side. The other stuff is important. It's not. He's not saying it doesn't matter. He's just saying that was part of their kind of cultural expression. Interesting. We're starting Matthew, and somebody said to me, "Are you doing the boring bit at the beginning?" Because Matthew begins with this lineage, and it's the fathers. Begins with Abraham and who his son was and who his son was and who his son was and who his son was, and it goes on for like dozens of names, dozens and dozens of generations. It's like, come on, please. And we're not used to that. I mean, I can't go back more than a couple of generations knowing my lineage. Most of us can't. Some of you, by the way you were talking, though, made me think like, okay, what, are you going back like 14 generations here? Like, you know, but it goes through the father in Matthew. Now, the Jewish people, they were also matrilineal in some ways, but the genealogy that Matthew includes, and the one in Luke as well, is the names of the fathers. It's patriarchal, it's paternal. But Matthew does something very interesting, and it's the part that makes it not just a boring list of names. It's what Matthew does with the list of names. Matthew is very clear from the beginning of the Gospel of Matthew that he is talking about Jesus, the Messiah, the one who was promised. This is, and he offers the lineage as Jesus' credentials. These are Jesus' credentials from Abraham to David. 14 generations from Abraham to David. And then 14 generations from David to the Babylonian captivity. And then 14 generations from the Babylonian captivity to Jesus, the Messiah, the Christ, the one who was to come. And Matthew is setting this up to help us understand Jesus' credentials. And it gets us asking questions, especially nowadays. Well, but what does that have to do with us? I mean, are we shaped by the generations who came before us? Well, yes, we are. Perhaps in ways that we don't know. Perhaps in ways that we haven't discovered. Perhaps there are connections that we didn't know about. Perhaps there are connections we still don't know. Or perhaps we assume that we're shaped in ways that, in fact, we were not shaped. And as we look at this passage of Scripture, it's very important to me, it's very important, period, to take the responsibility to treat the text with respect as much as we can, to be as honest as we can when we read it. This is old. It's 2,000 years old. It's a translation of something that has stayed in the church, in the people of faith, for all of that time, and they've said, no, we will not leave this piece out. What is it saying to us? And I'm going to assume that this text knows something that we don't. Matthew's trying to help us to see Jesus as the Messiah. He's painting a picture. He's building a case. And this is the beginning of him building this case. It might be helpful to think of it not so much as like a genealogy, a list of names, descendants, but kind of like poetry. It's kind of, think of it like like it's in couplets, because one of the things that Matthew does is he leaves out certain generations. He just leaves out their names. He doesn't talk about them. He skips them. Because it was the only way to get to 14, maybe. I don't know. And then in the last, from the Babylonian captivity to Jesus, if you count the names, Matthew, there's actually only 13 names here. You didn't include 14 names there. And so clearly Matthew, I think, is trying to do something else with the text, with this list of names. He's trying to say something that is not strictly historical genealogy. He's trying to make a point, and he points us to that by doing those things. Because remember, the people who were hearing this, the people who were first reading Matthew, they knew these names. They knew they recognized all of this stuff. And so they would notice if something was different. They would notice if he changed something. They'd pay attention to that. And they'd start to look for what is he trying to say here. He draws attention to a few things. And one of the things that he does is, as he's going through the list of men's names, fathers who begat, who had sons, who had sons, who had sons, he includes the names of some women. And it's interesting, because all of the women's names are connected to stories that are scandals. All of them. And this is really kind of getting us off on the wrong foot with Matthew, isn't it? I mean, this is the credentials. This is the carefully manicured CV of Jesus. These are his ancestors. These are the people that are supposed to give him credibility. And Matthew keeps pointing at the scandals. He begins with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the great names of the faith. And then he says, Jacob. Jacob had Judah. And Matthew breaks off and says, who had two sons by Tamar, Perez and Zerah. Matthew goes a few more names, and then he mentions Salmon, the father of Boaz. And then he says, oh, whose mother was Rahab. Well, Rahab, they know that story. People who first heard that would know Rahab was a prostitute. And she was not one of their own people. And Boaz was the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Oh, yeah, Ruth. Oh, yeah, she's one of the people we include, too. She was a Moabite. Moabites were the descendants, not just the scandal of Boaz marrying outside of his own people, but Ruth was a descendant of the Moabites, and the Moabites were the offspring resulting from an incestuous relationship between Lot and one of his daughters. And we go on. Obed was the father of Jesse, and Jesse was the father of King David. Okay, we're back on track here. King David, great King David, great King David, the warrior king, a man after God's own heart. And then he mentions and David was the father of Solomon, whose mother was Bathsheba, the widow of Uriah. Oh yeah, Bathsheba. David, the king, the man who stole another man's wife, and because he was the king and he could do whatever he wanted. And even if what he wanted was the wife of another man, Uriah, who was one of his own officers, who was someone who was so loyal to David, he would give everything to serve David. And this is how David treats him. Because when Bathsheba became pregnant with David's child and he couldn't cover it up, he had Uriah murdered. And he took Bathsheba to be his own wife. And she was the mother of Solomon, the great wise king. This is the genealogy that Matthew keeps presenting to us with these little aside comments, these little subversive references to remind the reader of the dark underbelly of the story of the genealogy of Jesus. I want to go back. So he begins. Abraham was the father of Isaac, who was the father of Jacob, who was the father of Judah. Judah, one of 12 brothers, the sons of Jacob. One of Judah's brothers was Joseph. Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, the smash Broadway musical, was based on that story loosely. with Donny Osmond. But it was that story. But as Genesis is telling the story of Joseph, it breaks off in this story of Judah, and we get to know a little bit about Judah. Judah and his brothers despised and resented Joseph. They hated him. They could kill him. I don't mean figuratively. They could kill him. And they tried. They threw him down a well, and they were considering how they were going to do it, how they were going to actually kill him. When some nomads came along and Judah said, hey, let's not kill him. Let's sell him into slavery. Human trafficking will make some money. And so they pulled him out of the well and they sold him to nomadic slave traders, human traffickers, who took him to another country. And they thought they'd never see him again, but they had to figure out what they were going to do. So they took his garment and they rolled it in some blood of a goat that they killed. His beautiful technicolor dream coat. And they presented it to their father, Jacob. Oh, gee, Dad, isn't that your son's coat? And they let their father believe, Judah and his brothers let their father believe that Joseph was dead, killed by a wild animal. And they let him believe that for years. Now, it breaks off in the story of Genesis. It breaks off here in the telling of that story, and it tells us about Judah. Just one chapter, chapter 38. You're welcome to go and find it sometime. Judah got married, and he had three sons, Onan, and Shelah. Grew up, and he married Tamar. Tamar, hence his Judah's daughter-in-law. Was a bad guy, it says, and God killed him because he was so wicked. And I'm thinking, gosh, you let Judah live, but you kill his son because he's so wicked? How wicked was What was he up to? Doesn't say. But that sets a dilemma. Tamar is a woman now widowed with no child, no son. And in their culture, the son was the one who would protect you when you got older. He was the one who would provide for you when you got older. He was like your retirement and your police force and your old age security and everything all together. If you don't have a son and you're widowed, you're in big trouble. And so for women who were childless and without a son and widowed, they had developed an odd kind of strategy. What they would do is they would marry the second son, a surviving brother of the husband, the widow or the dead husband, would father a child, would marry her and father a child for her, and that child would be considered his dead brother's son, would be the heir. And so the second son is in a conflict of interest now. Because if his brother's dead, he inherits everything from his dad. And so Onan, the second brother, he didn't want to father a child with Tamar. And so he kept sabotaging all of the efforts to get her pregnant. And so God killed him too, it says. And so Tamar is still left childless and without protection. And so she goes and she says, marry Shelah to me. And Judah says, Shelah's too young. He's not even of age yet. You know, you're going to have to wait. You wait until he's of age. And then, but he kept putting her off and putting her off and putting her off. And then eventually Judah's wife died. And Judah was wealthy. He went up the country to take care of his sheep. And Tamar knew that he was going up the country. And so she went up too. And she concealed her face, and as the custom in their culture, they were shrine prostitutes, they were called. They were prostitutes that were associated with kind of fertility stuff, mostly, I think. And she presented herself to Judah as a prostitute, with her face covered, shielded, behind a veil. He didn't know who she was. And he said, how much? He offered her a goat. She said, goat. Good. Okay, a goat. So he had sex with her. She said, whoa, what are you going to leave me for surety? You don't have your goat with you. How do I know you're going to pay me? Well, I can leave something with you. What do you want me to leave? Leave your identity seal and your walking staff. I'll keep those, and when you bring the goat later. So he gave her his identity seal and his walking staff, had sex with her. He left, told his servant, take the prostitute a goat. Servant goes to take her a goat, and there's no prostitute there. He asked the people in the town, where's the prostitute, the shrine prostitute that's on the road here? They said, what are you talking about? We've never had a shrine prostitute. Who do you think we are? And so the servant goes back to Judah. He says, there's no shrine prostitute. I couldn't deliver the goat. And Judah said, well, the identity stamp and the walking stick, they're not worth as much as a goat. So that's her problem. That's not mine. I tried to pay my bills, you know. And so he forgets it. Judah goes back home until rumors start to circulate. Rumors. Your unmarried daughter-in-law, Tamar, is 3 months pregnant. And Judah, filled with self-righteousness and indignation, how dare she? The little strumpet. Bring her right here in front of me and burn her, his words. Burn her. And so as she's coming, she brings and she says, the man who fathered this child is the one who owns this identity seal and this walking staff. Look closely at them. And he does. Now I'll give Judah credit, I guess, in this moment, in this one moment where he said, yes, he recognized it. And the penny dropped for Judah, and he figured it out. And he said, she has acted more righteously than I have. Passing herself off as a prostitute was a more righteous act than the way he had behaved toward her. He had failed in his responsibilities to protect her, to treat her with dignity and respect, to provide for her, to ensure that she would live a life that was safe and dignified, to ensure that she would be safe. And he refused to fulfill his obligations for that. This is what Matthew is saying. These are the credentials of Jesus. Not just the lineage of the people, not just the heroes of the faith, but the places they've been. And the places they've been have not been good. They have done the worst things that people ever do. Incest and rape and murder and lying and treachery and deception and failure and brokenness. That's who they are. And Matthew is very insistent all through that. And the names that he does mention call that into question. And then they start us thinking, well, what about the others? What about Abraham, who lied? What about Jacob, who cheated? His name means usurper. All of these people who went before Jesus, all of these people in his lineage, are people whose lives are filled with brokenness, failure. And I find this genealogy and Matthew's approach to it, when we read it like that, it changes it. It's not this carefully curated introduction of all of his good parts and what a good family, what a nice boy Jesus is, and what a nice family he comes from. I find it liberating to think that Jesus' own ancestors, the people who are held up as his credentials for Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of Man, the Son of God, they are people who are filled with failure and selfishness. They are people who regularly and repeatedly made a mess of things. And this is the gospel. This is the gospel that reminds us over and over that God does not float above our failures and our messiness. That God is present in our lives in the worst of the choices that we make And from the beginning, God is working his work of redemption. God mysteriously and strangely does not simply rip us out of the decay and the mess that we make. God enters the mess and gradually, slowly, incrementally redeems the mess and the pain and the harm that we do to each other, even to the people that we love. God enters our story, the story we tell ourselves, the story we tell people about who we think we are, and he gives us a lens of truthfulness to look at our own lives and our relationships and our shame and the embarrassment and the guilt and the failures and the fear. And he doesn't take those things away or pretend that they're not there. But he sees them with love, and he sees them in them a movement and grace and healing and redemption as he begins to slowly bring all those things to himself. And so this is the record of Jesus the Messiah, the descendant of David, the descendant of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac was the father of Jacob, and Jacob was the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. And Perez was the father of Hezron, and Hezron was the father of Ram, and Ram was the father of Amminadab, and Amminadab was the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon was the father of Salmon. Salmon was the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz was the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed was the father of Jesse, and Jesse was the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother was Bathsheba, the widow of Uriah. Solomon was the father of Rehoboam, and Rehoboam was the father of Abiah, and Abiah was the father of Asa, and Asa was the father of Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat was the father of Jeroboam, and Jeroboam was the father of Uzziah, and Uzziah was the father of Jotham, and Jotham was the father of Ahaz, and Ahaz was the father of Hezekiah, and Hezekiah was the father of Manasseh, and Manasseh was the father of Ammon, and Ammon was the father of Josiah, and Josiah was the father of Jehoiakim and his brothers, born at the time of the exile in Babylon. And after the exile, Jehoiakim was the father of Shealtiel, and Shealtiel was the father of Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel was the father of Abiad, and Abiad was the father of Eliakim, and Eliakim was the father of Azor, and Azor was the father of Zadok, and Zadok was the father of Akim, and Akim was the father of Eliud. And Eliud was the father of Eleazar, and Eleazar was the father of Matthan, and Matthan was the father of Jacob. And Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary. And Mary gave birth to Jesus, who is called the Messiah. All those listed above include 14 generations from Abraham to David, and 14 from David to the Babylonian exile, and 14 from the Babylonian exile to the Messiah. This is the record of Jesus the Messiah, the descendant of David and Abraham. Let us pray. God, in all of this, help us to see what you are trying to reveal to us. Help us to see not just the lineage and story of Jesus, but how our own story and our own lineage and all the broken things in our lives enter into this story, and that you are present in all of it, and you are redeeming and working in all of our stories, drawing us closer to you and redeeming us. In Jesus' name, amen.